Good evening. My name is Helen Hopper, and I am a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. I would like to acknowledge Catherine McNamara for her work in co-managing this event. On behalf of the Clark Forum, it is my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's event, People Power in the Middle East, Challenges for U.S. Policy. Former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice once quipped that America had traded freedom for stability in the Middle East, but had got neither. With popular uprisings threatening many of America's strongest regional allies, such as Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, Jordanian ruler King Abdullah II, and Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh, how should the Obama administration respond? We are fortunate to have a distinguished panel here with us this evening to discuss various aspects of these events. Ed Webb is an assistant professor of political science and international studies and a founder of Dickinson's Middle East Studies program. He has particular interests in the interaction of religions and politics and the politics of education, as well as authoritarianism and empire. His interest in pedagogical applications of new technologies, including simulations, games, and social media, has led him to being appointed to the advisory board of the National Institute for Technology and Liberal Education. Andrew Wolf is an assistant professor of political science and international studies at Dickinson College. His areas of teaching include U.S. foreign policy, transatlantic relations, NATO security policy, international relations theory, and European politics. Currently, his primary research concerns the geopolitics of NATO enlargement in Central and Eastern Europe. He has also been a legal staff assistant in the United States Senate and an English teacher in the Czech Republic. Larry Goodson is a professor of Middle East Studies at the U.S. Army War College. In 2008 to 2009, he served on a four-year temporary assignment with the U.S. Central Command Assessment Team, where he focused on U.S. strategy and policy towards Afghanistan and Pakistan for General David Petraeus. Goodson is the author of the New York Times best-selling Afghanistan's Endless War, State Failure, Regional Politics, and the Rise of the Taliban, published in 2001, and the forthcoming Pakistan, Understanding the Dark Side of the Moon. W. Andrew Terrell is the Strategic Studies Institute's Middle East Specialist at the U.S. Army War College. He has published in numerous academic journals on topics including nuclear proliferation, the Iran-Iraq War, Operation Desert Storm, Middle Eastern chemical weapons, ballistic missile proliferation, terrorism, and commando operations. Since 1994, Dr. Terrell has participated in the Middle Eastern Track 2 talks, which are part of the Middle East peace process. He has also served as a member of the Military and Security Working Group of the Baker-Hamilton Iraq Study Group throughout its existence in 2006. Our moderator, David Cummins, is a professor of history at the Benjamin Rush Distinguished Chair in Liberal Arts and Sciences at Dickinson College. His teaching interests are in modern Middle Eastern history with an emphasis on Islamic thought and political movements. His current research is on the relationship between the Salafi and Wahhabi streams in modern Islamic thought. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and pagers. There will be a question and answer session immediately following the program, so please hold all questions until that time. And now, please join me in welcoming our panelists.
Thank you, Helen. We don't need that. I can barely see over it. Before we proceed with the event, I want to thank the students who proposed this event. They are the student members of the Middle East Studies Majors Committee, and they are Katie Corrali, Sarah Glass, Alex Leese, and Ian Mandel. They pitched this idea not even 2 weeks ago. I really appreciate their coming up with this, and I'm sure that you will find the remarks of the panelists to be very stimulating. And if you know any of these students or run into them, please thank them on your way out. With no further ado, I'm turning the event over to Ed Webb.
Thank you, David. Okay, I'm going to try and get up what was up there before in a moment. I'm really going to talk about two things. One is, what is the nature of the events we're seeing? What are we observing? What has brought us here tonight that connects Tunisia to Egypt and potentially connects those two countries and the events there to Yemen, Jordan, possibly Syria, possibly Saudi Arabia? Who knows where this is going? So we need to understand what these events are, what's going on, and try and get some sense of the likelihood of further, one word would be contagion, if we think of this maybe as a negative or worrying phenomenon, demonstration effects. What is it that is spreading through the North Africa and the Middle East? That will be mostly what I talk about. I want to talk about the role of technology, particularly communications technology, in these events. The second point I will come to towards the end is the uncertainty of what's going on. These are revolutionary events, and a lot of what we should know, we just don't know. So I would like to emphasize that at the end. Okay, technical hitch. You know, we don't have time. All right. What I was going to show you were things that I would encourage you to go and look at online, explore these things. One are the social media tools that I'm about to talk about. But even more than that, I would encourage you to spend some time watching Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera, particularly in English, which so you don't need the Arabic language. If you know Arabic, of course, you should take a look at the Al Jazeera Arabic channel. But what we're seeing, and the reason that we're thinking about events spreading from one country to another in the region, is essentially, as I say, a matter of contagion or spread, ideas jumping from one country to the next. The social media aspects of this are important, but I would encourage you to look at Al Jazeera. Why Al Jazeera? Why not CNN? Why not BBC? These are all active in the region. Al Jazeera has really, I think, made quite a deliberate choice to make these events its own, to make this a moment of establishing its brand, attaching itself to particular events. From the perspective of the Egyptian regime, certainly Al Jazeera is seen as a hostile entity. They've tried to close Al Jazeera down. They've closed their office down, they've withdrawn their press cards, they've arrested their journalists, they've harassed them. That tells us something. From the Egyptian perspective, Al Jazeera is dangerous. Why? Because they're showing something across the Arab world, and now because of the reach of Al Jazeera English, across the English-speaking world, that has broken what activists in the field are calling the fear barrier. And we've heard this time and time again from people being interviewed, not only on Al Jazeera, by other journalists too. We see it in the Twitter stream. We see people talking about the fear barrier having been broken, the fear having gone away. So what does that mean? It means that the events that started in Tunisia in December, very recently, but the events that started with a young man in frustration at the oppression, the random oppression of a police state, setting himself on fire as a public protest, the way that took off, others tragically followed his example, but others took to the streets, protested, essentially faced down a regime, and then leading to what nobody thought would happen. An Arab strongman, this is a word that we're used to thinking about when we think about the autocratic rulers in the Middle East, an Arab strongman not being so strong, getting on the plane, leaving town, trying to find somewhere that would accept him, ultimately Saudi Arabia. The revolution will not be televised. We know this from the 60s, right? But in this case, the revolution has been televised. And for all the noise about Twitter and other things that I'm about to talk about, television really has been really crucial in this. And I'll come back to television in a moment and show another example of what this is. But young Arabs and other Arabs, but particularly young Arabs, there's a demographic issue. I think Larry's going to talk about this a bit. Young Arabs have seen other young Arabs essentially face down a regime, chase the dictator out of town. This is a very extraordinarily powerful thing to see. And that's not enough. That doesn't explain everything that's going on. But it certainly makes a difference. Al Jazeera actually was criticized by some activists in the region for being slow to pick up on the events in Tunisia. This thing that started in the poor provincial town of Sidi Bouzid. But once they got on it, they really got on it. And they got these pictures out there and have changed minds, as I say, shattering this fear barrier, giving the sense, I think, to people that if they get together, then they can face down the regimes. It's not going to work everywhere. But that is one huge part of this. Apart from television, social media. If you've been following these events in, well, choose your own media of choice, you've probably seen mention of this as maybe a Twitter revolution or a Facebook revolution, marginally a WikiLeaks revolution. I'm going to leave that one aside. But certainly the social media tools have been getting a lot of attention. And if you look at the way analysts are talking about this, as well as activists in the region, you'll see, I think, certainly more skeptical analysts, people like Malcolm Gladwell, Evgeny Morozov, essentially saying the social media has nothing to do with this. There were plenty of revolutions before Twitter was invented. Clearly, you don't need Twitter to have a revolution, which is a fair point, if a banal one. You always need some kind of communication. So we should pay some attention to the tools. At the other end, we have what are derisively called, I think, techno-utopians, who say the whole thing is about social media. Facebook made this revolution, made that revolution, which again, obviously, is an exaggeration of events. What made these events were people getting out into the streets in large enough numbers to overwhelm the forces of police states. But how you get them there does involve communication, clearly. Most of the activists seem to credit social media with some important role in this. If you look at the pictures from Tahrir Square, Liberation Square in Cairo, you'll see some of the signs, some of the graffiti that people are displaying, mentioning Twitter and Facebook. On Twitter, two hashtags. If you're not familiar with Twitter, a hashtag is just a way of calling out something in your tweet message of 140 characters or less as being connected to a particular subject. So the hashtag Sidi Bouzid, meaning you put the hash sign and the word Sidi Bouzid in your tweet, helped spread the word of what was going on in Tunisia early on. You still see it. Don't forget Tunisia. That revolution is still going on. And if you go on Twitter and search for the hashtag Sidi Bouzid, it's not shooting by like the equivalent hashtags from Egypt are, but it's still very active. Activists in Tunisia, outside Tunisia, connected to Tunisia, in other parts of the Arab world, in the West, are exchanging ideas, amplifying the message about what's going on there. In the case of Cairo, the key hashtag to look for is #Jan25, January 25th. Because that was the first day of protests there. And so even though we're obviously well past there into the third week of these events in Egypt, Jan 25 is still what to look for. What I'd hope to show you is this shoots by really, really quickly. So in the time that I've been talking, there would probably be, I'm guessing, how long have I been talking now? I'm guessing you'd see probably in the region of 400 to 500 new tweets just in this time, about January 25, meaning events in Cairo connected to it. Obviously, a lot of that, you can't keep up with that, and a lot of it is people repeating each other's messages, the amplification effect of social media that's important here. Coming to Facebook, the reason January 25 started at all as a protest, partly was because of events in Tunisia and this breaking of the fear barrier and the idea that people could get out in the streets and really affect political change by doing that. But this didn't happen out of nowhere. In Egypt, activists, trade unionists, opposition party members, all sorts of people, journalists, have been working for years, have been actually having protests for years. Some of it organized by social media, some of it not. The events of January 25th were kicked off largely by a Facebook page, which is a tribute to a young Egyptian who was assassinated, essentially, by the police in Alexandria. On January 25th itself, a Google executive, Wael Ghanim, who was one of the group of people who had put that page up, was kidnapped from the streets by security forces in Egypt. He was just released yesterday. He's a very important figure, not because he works for Google, although people love Google. He's a very important figure because people have been asking about him daily since he was taken. He came out of custody yesterday, partly because people have pressured the regime, partly because the National Democratic Party, which seems to be disintegrating in Egypt, a senior member of that party went to get him, essentially. He came out and he talked to the media twice in incredibly moving and powerful terms about the peaceful aims of the revolution, commiserations, condolences to the families of the dead, and made a huge impact. Again, and here's where TV comes back in again. It's all very well for the activists and others to look at the Facebook and the Twitter and all this stuff. But he was then on TV making this incredibly moving statements and actually breaking down in tears when they showed him pictures of people who died in these protests. And today in Tahrir and around the country, the number of protesters out in the streets has gone up by tens of thousands. Mostly people think because of his appearance. So he's an important figure, not because he's a revolutionary genius, not because he is better connected with the political establishment or the opposition establishment in Egypt. He's an incredibly important figure because he's been fronting this in some way. But he's just one of many organizers. He's just become a figurehead, partly because of accident, partly because of Facebook, partly because of television. So media of different kinds, older and newer kinds, have been really important in breaking the fear barrier, in allowing activists to coordinate, and in reaching a broader population. And the Egyptian government's control of its own media, which up until a couple of days ago seemed very tight, now seems to be slipping. You have essentially rebellion from journalists in the national TV station, in the government-owned media, and you're beginning to see even the national media, which had been essentially almost ridiculously propagandistic for the past few days, now beginning to report and argue about these events. And so that's another change that's very important. These traditional media still matter. Don't get overexcited about Twitter and forget that newspapers are still read, television is still watched, and these have an effect. Briefly, my last point is about the uncertainty wars. We're watching a revolution in real time, or something that people involved in it call a revolution anyway. And I think they're not wrong to use that word. No one knows what happens next. We can game out all sorts of scenarios. But what we see day to day is apparently unimportant things or relatively unimportant things seem to have very large effects. So a 30-year-old Google executive comes out of custody, talks to a couple of TV stations. Suddenly he's a figurehead where there was no figurehead really for the Tahrir demonstrators. And yesterday, presumably, the regime, when they let him go, didn't expect that. But we didn't expect that. Nobody, I think, knew exactly how this was going to go. No one knows what happens next. The reason I'm saying this is if we're thinking about U.S. interests here and what the U.S. should do, one hugely important thing to recognize is there is a limited number of things the U.S. can do. There are relatively small number of tools in our toolkit here about how to react, respond, hopefully, possibly nudge, steer these events. There is no magic democracy words. Mark Lynch, an observer of all this, said President Obama can't come out and say magic democracy words and make Mubarak disappear and the regime disappear and a new republic arise. It's not like that. We don't know what's happening. The protesters don't know what's going to happen. The regime, in its different bits, seems rather confused in some of its responses. They don't know. And I think we really do need to keep that in mind when we're thinking about what the U.S. should or shouldn't do, what U.S. spokespeople should and shouldn't say. I have to say something, right? The U.S. is the superpower, but recognize there are very, very real limits on the effect of that. So finally, on the contagion point, we're going to hear from some other people who are rather more knowledgeable than I about other places in the region. One thing to bear in mind about the idea that all the Middle East is going to fall over like dominoes, which some of the protesters have been evoking this domino image, is these countries are very different from one another. The contagion effect, the demonstration effect, happens because there is an Arab public sphere, because Al Jazeera and social networking, these things have built an Arab public sphere that stretches between these countries, connects them. But Tunisia is not Egypt, is not Yemen, is not Jordan, is not Saudi. Among the key differences is the different role of the military in these countries. In Tunisia, the military was not the core of the regime in the way that it is in Egypt. And that is going to make a huge difference in where things go from here. Absolutely critical difference. And that's just one example. So although we can talk about the region at large and try to see what's going on and how the U.S. might think about its interests in the region at large, we do need to bear in mind the very real differences between these countries and within these countries, and not lose sight of that. And with that, I hand it over.
Thanks, David. Hi, I'm Larry Goodson from the War College, and I would begin by also saying, thank you to the students who came up with this idea, people power at Dickinson College, just like we have in the Middle East. I'll also say very quickly the ritual disclaimer and put pressure on my colleague to do the same thing. What I'm going to say now are my views and not necessarily those of the War College or the government that I work for. I should probably mention at the outset, although I'm not going to belabor this point, that I lived in Cairo for 6 years, from 1994 to 2000, when I was a member of the faculty at the American University in Cairo, where I saw you had some students come back from there. Hope I'll get to see them tonight and chat with them a little bit. And so they want me to talk a bit about Egypt, and I do intend to do that. But let me just say a few general words first, and that is that the winter of 2010-2011 is likely to be remembered, since we have to have a catchy slogan, as the winter of rage in the Arab world. But when I talked to my friends in the Egyptian movement, they want it to be known as the winter of change in the Arab world, and perhaps it will be. We've already had the jasmine or dignity revolution in Tunisia, which, as we heard, sort of sparked off Egypt's ongoing Lotus Revolution, and together these events have sparked protests and similar kinds of events in numerous Arab countries, or potentially similar events in numerous Arab countries, Yemen, Jordan, Algeria, Sudan, and or preemptive moves toward reform in some of those and other countries. The reality is that autocracy has long shaped the political contours of this region, which is the least democratic in the world. Even as its political systems have proven relatively robust and enduring, many changes have occurred in the world that have put enormous pressure on these hard but often brittle regimes. And I'm going to talk a little bit about two of those phenomena, the demographic explosion and economic stagnation within the region. And then, as you've already heard, those phenomena combined with the power of globalization, technological change, to sort of usher in and move along this movement for reform. I do want to say a few quick words about Egypt in general, because I think what we're seeing there now is sort of the aging third generation government of a revolution. Remember, Egypt's government was founded by a revolution at the beginning of the 1950s. Hosni Mubarak is the only the, you know, if we don't count Naguib, only the third leader of that government. We had Gamal Abdel Nasser, then we had Anwar Sadat, and then when Sadat was assassinated, his vice president becomes president, and he's been in power ever since, bolstered by emergency rule ever since he came into power. So that's a long time for a government that was founded by a revolution to be in, a revolution, of course, of the free officers to be in power. And I mention that because this puts the government in a very awkward position. It is a government bolstered by an army, as Ed was just saying, that itself has been aging and has been living off of itself all these years. The state has not been able to really provide an economic foundation that the country could grow from, and the senior officers in the military have become increasingly disconnected from the junior ranks in the military, even though this is one of the largest and strongest militaries in the Arab world. And so I was trying to think about lessons for dictators from all of this. I knew Ed was going to talk about, you know, lessons for sort of students that are in the square. My office used to be right there. As you know, in the old days, the American University in Cairo was right on Tahrir Square. Now most of the campus is out in the Katameya, in the hills south of the city. And so I was right there across that square all the time. So to see it every day and to see all this going on there is really quite, imagine your hometown and this sort of thing is happening. But anyway, my thought for autocrats or dictators was very simple. And that is, you absolutely, in a region of contagion, must not allow sparks to ignite. Because if they occur and they ignite, you're going to go. You have to be ruthless. So if Andy here challenges my regime, I should kill him immediately. And I should kill his family. And I should salt the earth where his house was, right? I mean, I should be absolutely ruthless. And I should do that when things are happening in Tunisia, because if I wait for it to break out in Egypt, I'm going to be making concessions from a position of weakness, which is, of course, where we find Hosni Mubarak today. And we saw that, I mean, if we were to look back in a historical sense, we saw that in 1989 when, the various dictators of Eastern Europe tried to make concessions and suddenly found themselves, you know, sent packing, because once the mob was pushing, they had no hope. But having said that, I just want to say something very quickly about Egypt, and then I'm going to give you my implications and stay on time as best I can anyway. Egypt poses an interesting variation, because what has President Mubarak been doing these last 3 weeks? He's been dangling the carrot and then wielding the stick every other day. It's been the one and then the other. Well, I'm not actually really going to run for re-election ever again. I was going to run for an 87th term of office, but I'm not going to now. I'm definitely going to go in September. And now, the next day, there's some, effort at repression. If it works for you better, think of concession, repression. Concession, repression. The biggest stick in his arsenal he can't actually use, and that's the army. Because the army is comprised of conscripted soldiers, largely from the fellaheen, from the poor former peasants and urban poor, the young guys who have to go into the army and serve their term in national duty. That's different from the officers and so forth. And those people, according to what we're hearing through social media and other sources, are basically saying, I will not fire on the people. So he can't use the big stick. Moreover, I'm not sure the President of the United States and others would really stand by to see that happen. So we're seeing concession, repression, concession, repression. It's very interesting. I mean, in a purely sort of detached sense, leaving aside the human cost connected to it, because it just might work. If he can break this cycle that we just heard about, where the social media kind of amplify and create pressure that he can't resist, he just might stay in office long enough to manage a transition and leave on something like his own terms. But anyway, I just wanted to say that about what was going on. I have three implications of all of what's going on, primarily focused on Egypt. I'm just going to give them to you very quickly and then get out of the way of Andy and Andy. The first one is this. Democracy is a nice thing, not to be undervalued from here or by skittish foreign powers who prefer stable but oppressive dictators. And so I'm not trying to talk it down, right? But the problems of the region are too deep, in my mind, and too dramatic for democracy or any political reform to fix, at least in the short term. This, I think, is the most important implication that I haven't been getting regularly from CNN, Fox, MSNBC, and all the rest that have been talking about the events of the moment. Second, Egypt provides one of numerous global shocks that now ripple across the planet with, as we've already heard, very few barriers to insulate other places from the contagion. I just mentioned, you know, the mainstream media, but as you just heard, you don't even have to get your news from Tahrir from them. You can just go to the Twitter feed if you want to, or you can go to Al Jazeera if you want a different take on it. And then third, a crisis of governance, I think, is perceived to exist around the world and definitely exists within the Arab world that combines with poor economic conditions and the spread of the social media to make these problems seem even worse to people. Now, let me just give you a couple of quick thoughts on all of these. Since the Six-Day War of 1967, which was a big watershed event in Middle Eastern history, so roughly the last 45 years, the Middle Eastern population has tripled. Today it's about 350 million people, which exceeds the population of the United States and Canada. Let me just focus on Egypt for the rest of this as an illustration of the broader problems of the region. Egypt has a population of about 80 million people. It's the largest country of the Middle East and has always seen itself as the leader of the Arab world. Not all the Arabs agree with that, but anyway. Today, its average annual population growth rate is 2%, which puts it well ahead of the 0.97% of the United States and the negative or virtual zero population growth rates for much of Europe. To put that in a different way, since 1950, the U.S. population has doubled, it's now about 310 million, while Egypt's population quadrupled. Or put another way, our population is going to double in another three quarters of a century for Egypt, maybe 31, 32 years. This remarkable demographic growth intersects with economics to produce startling consequences. The most important, I think, of these is that Middle Eastern countries typically have a very large youth bulge in their populations. The median age of Egypt's population is now 24. For the United States, 37, okay? Which means, more simply, almost half of Egypt's population is younger than the college students sitting here in the room. The rapid population increase over these last 50 years has produced enormous strains on Egypt's government and the other governments in the region where this has occurred. And these governments have had to provide social services and economic opportunities at far higher rates than in the United States and far higher rates than their economies could possibly manage. For Egypt, this has meant that it has had to produce jobs at about 3 to 4 times the usual annual rate of U.S. job growth in order to keep unemployment rates from rising. Plus, it has to lie about what the unemployment rates are. Egypt's unemployment has been at 10% or higher for some years now, and youth unemployment is usually 20% and higher from there. So the broader economic reality is simple and profound. Other than oil and gas, where the region has 65% of known world reserves, this is a region with no absolute economic advantage in anything, a ticking demographic time bomb, and no solutions to its economic problems. There is no viable economic foundation upon which this region can grow its way out of this situation that I can see anyway, except for the oil and gas that some of the states in the region rely on so heavily. So, to conclude, people power, as we're calling it and as they're calling it, is exciting and overdue, and it will undoubtedly ripple through the region in ways both anticipated and unforeseen, with both positive and negative effects. But the ripple effects from Medan al-Tahrir or Tahrir Square extend beyond the region. That is, as I said before, our global interconnectedness means that there are few barriers between countries and places, and ripples in one place can turn into a tsunami somewhere else. So Egypt and Tunisia, or if you will, Cairo and Tunis, are just two ponds on the planet where a few rocks have created ripples that are washing across other far-flung and different shores. The effort of the Egyptian authorities to close down the internet, to close down the access of the media, and the dramatic influence of the social media sites to spread the news merely serve, I think, to highlight the flat nature of the globe today. So to sort of disagree a bit here with Ed, I would say that any place is every place. And events in Cairo, important as they are there, and I don't mean to diminish, you know, that for any of the people there, have an importance that transcends Egypt. The world economy, as we know in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, has been sluggish and fragile these past several years, and events in many places have affected the price of food and energy, the creation of jobs, causing economic crises such that we have had not only an American but a global recession. So that's why I've said, and this is my last thought, and it's sort of a twist on what I was saying, that's why I've said that the big issue here in many respects is the crisis of governance in Cairo and in the other Middle Eastern countries that are being challenged. Frankly, the Mubarak stasis, I guess, had some advantages of some sort for the United States and the region because it kept the lid not on the people of Egypt, it did do that, but on the dire economic reality of Egypt and, as it's been playing out elsewhere, much of the rest of the Middle East as well. But it seems that the Arab youth have awakened. They know their conditions are no longer justifiable. They can simply go to the internet and see that. They don't need to sacrifice for national development because national development states gave them crummy economies. What are they sacrificing for if they're doing that? They don't need to sacrifice for pan-Arabic unity because that idea went out in the, you know, in the 60s. They don't need to sacrifice for anti-Israeli solidarity because that war, maybe it's not over, should be. Anyway, it seems to be ending in important ways. Moreover, their entire lives until now have been about sacrifice, except for the super rich who don't really do sacrifice. But for all the rest of the Arab youth, they've increasingly and recently become aware that they don't want to make sacrifices anymore. They want lives, it seems to me, and this is what I'm hearing from my friends over there, my former students, of material well-being, personal choice, and political freedom. I wrote down what I was told. All right, so material well-being, personal choice, political freedom. Here's what I'm worried about. The change of government will lead to political change, maybe even political freedom. I don't think it'll lead to material well-being, and therefore I'm not sure what it will do for personal choice. So that's why I'm very concerned about how all of this will play out tonight, and thank you very much.
Thanks, Larry, and also for shooting myself, my family, and sorry, I'm not very assault, but yeah, no, I'm kidding. I'm Andy Terrell. I am also with the U.S. Army War College. I'm with the Strategic Studies Institute of the U.S. Army War College, and I also need to, as Larry did, give you a disclaimer that the presentation I'm giving you represents my own ideas. I do not speak for the War College. I do not speak for the Army. I do not speak for the U.S. government. I'm here right now thanks to your gracious invitation, and like my predecessors up here, I'd like to thank the Clark Forum and thank the students for inviting me here to be part of this. What my topic is going to be some of the spillover effects, specifically looking at the countries of Yemen and Jordan. Obviously, I can't give you a really solid background on these countries in 10 minutes. If you are interested, I've recently published this publication on Yemen. It is free and downloadable from a Strategic Studies Institute website. If you run Strategic Studies Institute, or if you run my name, you will get there. Likewise, I published a couple years ago a similar study on Jordan. It is also free and downloadable. I have a book on Jordan that came out about 6 months ago with Prager Press, but that unfortunately is beyond the means of a student budget in most cases. But please feel free, at least with the Strategic Studies Institute resources, to take advantage of them if you choose to find whatever I have to say interesting. What has been discussed already has been the possibility of spillover, contingent, whatever. And when you're looking at the press or when you're looking at commentary, you most often see after Tunisia and after Egypt, the names that come up tend to be Yemen and Jordan, because we have seen demonstrations there, demonstrations in Yemen a lot more serious than those in Jordan. But I did want to sort of suggest that when you think about Yemen, and let's take Yemen first, it is a considerable interest to the United States. And I would invite you to think back to December 2009 when we had an attempt by a Yemeni-trained terrorist to destroy a plane full of over 200 people on its way to Detroit, and that plot was indeed foiled. What if it wasn't foiled? What if it had succeeded? What if 200 and some odd people had been killed by a terrorist trained in Yemen? What would the United States do next? Would we be involved now in a third war in the Middle East? And not a very easy war to win, because this is not a country that takes well to a foreign presence at all, let alone a foreign invasion. Maybe we'd be too smart for that. Some people are saying we're too smart for that, and every time I say we're too smart for something, then we do it. So it's at least a question worth thinking about, and it's worth thinking about when you look at Yemen. And taking a look at Yemen, we see that, again, we have this major al-Qaeda presence there. And so when you're seeing several towns have been seized and held for a little while before the army can finally drive them out, it's something that the president and the National Security Council have reason to worry about. And as we're thinking about this, then we see, what if this spills over? What if we have a collapse of authority in Yemen when we have so much at stake? And if you look at Yemen, there are very few countries that have a right to a revolution more solidly than the people of Yemen. The conditions there seem to cry out for revolution. You have the poorest country in the Arab world. You have, of 23.5 million people, you have over 7 million of them, so you're talking almost a third, living in chronic hunger. You have 35% unemployment. That's the official figure. That's what, three and a half times what we've got in Egypt. We've got corruption that's absolutely mind-boggling. And we have, if you look at the Transparency International, the international watchdog organization, and see where Yemen stands, it's well below Egypt. It's dramatically below Jordan. And it is It is ahead of only one other Arab state. Only one other Arab state is more corrupt than Yemen. And I bet you know what it is. It's Iraq. So in any event, this is a situation that seems to be a powder keg. Add to that diminishing resources, growing population. World Bank says they're going to run out of oil. They don't have a lot to begin with by 2017. And Yemen, in the capital city of Sana'a, may be the first city in the world to run out of water. So this is a hard situation to deal with. The president of Yemen has been in power since 1978. He was the first the president of North Yemen. Then he became the president of United Yemen. And so he is the one that's facing this down. Immediately before all of this unrest broke out in Tunisia and Egypt, he had a busy time because he was tinkering with the constitution in ways that would allow him to keep running for president more or less forever. Well, then Tunisia came and Egypt came, and what we saw there was the president trying to get out ahead of the situation. And what he did under those circumstances is he promised not to run again. He promised his son, Ahmed, who's a colonel in the Republican Guard, would not run. He's made a whole lot of statements about lowering taxes, providing additional help for struggling people. He's especially good to students because students have been very strong in the demonstrations. And he's trying to make sure that this unrest that we see hasn't had a chance to get a foothold. When he says, by the way, that he's not going to run for president, that's not the first time he said that. Prior to the last election, he said he wasn't going to run for president, and he changed his mind, the 2006 election. So people have good reason not to believe him. In any event, he has shown, despite all this sort of pre-revolutionary conditions, you might suggest, he has shown some dexterity in manipulation and managing to diffuse the situation somewhat. We are seeing boycotts of the parliament. We are seeing some demonstrations that seem to ebb and flow. Most of the demonstrations are by Sana'a University. Sana'a University, I've been there, is a huge university. The webpage says 45,000. I was told 50,000 when I was there, and I was there some time ago. It's a big university. And so you have students probably forming the nucleus of a lot of the unrest that's going on. And President Saleh, as I say, is trying very hard to make students' lives easier so he would be able to perhaps take some of the steam out of that. He may, in fact, be able to deliver on some of these checks he's writing, these promises he's making, these money he's saying he's going to provide for some of these programs he's suggesting, lower taxes and all of that, because he can go hat in hand to Riyadh, to Saudi Arabia, and say, I'm in a pre-revolutionary situation, I need some money. And the Saudis, who have a 800-mile border with Yemen, could very well find that receptive. They don't want revolutionary turmoil in Yemen. That's too close to home as far as they are concerned. So the bottom line is for that, and again, it's just a thumbnail. In the immediate aftermath of this, he seems to have done an adequate job of controlling the situation and managing it. He is a crisis manager. He can't be the president of Yemen since 1978 and not be a crisis manager. But he's not going to address the underlying systemic problems in any serious way, and so you've got some real issues. Jordan is somewhat very different, and that's one of the things I do want to make the case about. Jordan, we've had much smaller demonstrations. Jordan is also a country that the United States has a great deal of interest in, not only because since 1994 it's had a peace treaty with Israel, but it's also a major player in the struggle against al-Qaeda. I've written a chapter about that in my most recent book about Jordan and terrorism. But Jordan has had a great deal to do with that, and we can explore that more in the question and answer period if you're interested. Moreover, while the United States appreciates Jordan, Jordan understands that to break away from the United States or to form some kind of a revolutionary government that gets rid of the Hashemite monarchy, it's a very risky thing. This is a country that has very, very miserable natural resources. It has no oil except oil shale, which is not exploitable at this point in time. It basically has potash and phosphates and fertilizer and tourism on a good day. And so you don't have a lot there. And the Jordanians basically know that they're dependent on foreign aid, and the best donor for foreign aid is the United States. They've been in trouble with the United States before, specifically in 1991, when they tilted towards Saddam Hussein in the in Operation Desert Storm, and they really paid a heavy price for that. The economy really suffered. Nobody wants to go through that again. And so, in some respects, people look at the situation very realistically in Jordan, and they say, we are going to demonstrate for better conditions. We're going to demonstrate for getting rid of Samir Rafai and his fat cat cronies as prime minister. But we're not demonstrating against the Hashemites. There's too many things that can go wrong if that starts to unravel. So there is some built-in restraint in the system. It is, however, interesting to me that that King Abdullah, it's not surprising he sacked Samir Rafai, but it was interesting to me he appointed Maruf Bakit as the new prime minister. I met Maruf in the 90s. I don't doubt he remembers me. It's Track 2 conferences I attended. But he is, Maruf Bakit is, he's Mr. Security in Jordan. He's been the director of the intelligence agency, the GID. He's a retired general in the Jordanian army. And when Al-Qaeda struck Western hotels in Jordan in 2005, he was named prime minister, moved from national security advisor's position to be prime minister. His charge was to wage war against Al-Qaeda in Jordan and also outside Jordan. The Jordanians claim that they had a very big role, and we obviously don't know the details, in tracking down and finding Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was killed by the United States Air Force. Jordanians suggest it was they that got the information. So this is a fairly tough guy that's been appointed. This is a guy who knows security, and he doesn't look like the reformer coming to fix the economy. So even though I'm sort of saying I don't think Jordan's in a pre-revolutionary situation, the king isn't taking a whole lot of chances. And while you don't have the same corruption as in Egypt, or certainly not as in Yemen, Jordan ranks around Eastern Europe in the corruption indexes. If you sort of look at some of the other things, there is a very high level of unemployment, again, not like Yemen, about like Egypt. And then you also have questions of youth bulge, again, Jordan, Yemen, all the same. So the king is definitely concerned enough to appoint someone who can be tough if need to be, as the new prime minister. So both of these countries, very interesting. We'll see how they play out. I give Jordan a lot better chance than Yemen in the long run, but we'll have to see. Thank you.
Good evening. I'm Andy Wolf, and I'm in the Political Science and International Studies Department at Dickinson College. It's a pleasure to be here. Many of my students, I teach an American foreign policy class. Many of my students are here. I required them to be here. Interestingly, Helen, our Clark Forum manager, she's in my class. But she also required that I'm here, since she's running the show. So it's a weird interplay here. I am going to be speaking tonight directly about U.S. foreign policy. Unlike the other panelists, I am not a regional expert in the Middle East. I haven't lived in Egypt. And I think most of the panel has lived in Egypt and traveled there heavily. My expertise is following what the U.S. does in U.S. foreign policy in the world. And I've been watching very closely about how the U.S. is reacting and thinking about how this compares to other events in history and how we've dealt with other revolutions. So what I want you to take away from my talk tonight and my comments tonight are three things. Number one, I would like to clarify exactly what is U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. Not in the Middle East, but in Egypt. What are our national interests in Egypt? Why are we so involved and intertwined in this revolution and in this regime? Number two, I would like to assess President Obama's performance to date. Right? How's he doing? Is he doing a good job, fair job, bad job? And this is my assessment. This is what I've come up with. And I hope you disagree with me. I hope some of you agree with me also. But this is something I think is very important to ask, particularly of our political leaders. Are they doing a good job? And thirdly, I'd like to stress this tension that we have in our foreign policy. And it's a tension between security concerns and our national values, or promoting or reflecting our values. And this tension is in many areas, but in the Middle East, it really comes up. And in this situation, it's really coming out. Should our strategic concerns, our security concerns, trump the promotion of our values? Or should the promotion of our values and a reflecting what we as a society operate on, sort of ideas of liberty, democracy, human rights, etc., should that trump our strategic interests? Or do they naturally coincide? Do they go hand in hand together? Answering that question, depending on, however you answer it, however you interpret it, will tell you what the U.S. should or should not be doing. That's really, for me, the critical question. What are our political leaders thinking about that? As far as U.S. long-term interests in the region. So let me just get right to it. What are U.S. interests in Egypt? Well, this is coming directly from the horse's mouth, from political leaders. Vice President Biden, he 2 weeks ago, he said exactly what our interests are in Egypt. Our interests there are, number one, and these are in rank order, our number one interest is ensuring that Egypt adheres to the Camp David Accords, making sure that Egypt maintains peace with Israel. That really is our overriding number one security interest, our number one national interest. That is what officials, I would think, worry about the most in this situation. Will the revolution spark some sort of war or renewed conflict in the Middle East that will draw in Israel and be involved with Israel? Our number two national interest vis-a-vis Egypt is keeping them as a regional partner. And this is very important as well. Egypt has been a loyal ally in our past. They've helped out in a number of areas, in terrorism, counterterrorism, domestically in Egypt, but also internationally. We share intelligence resources with them. For instance, during the Iraq War, they opened up their airspace to our planes. They offer political support and influence in the region. They are a regional partner, and we don't want to lose that. And if Egypt that's not interested in being a government that's not interested in being friendly with the U.S. or turns hostile to us, is really will impact our policy in the Middle East. Third interest vis-a-vis Egypt is political reform and democratization. That is a major priority for our policymakers. I mean, President Bush talked about it. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice went to Cairo in 2005 and called for political reform in Egypt. President Obama was in Cairo in 2009. He said he wanted to reestablish U.S.-Arab relations, Muslim relations, and he talked about reform. Now, deeds may not follow words, but our leaders are definitely iterating that this is a national priority, that there needs to be democratic reform in the region. So those are the three interests. Okay. Now, let's turn to judging Obama's performance. Excuse me, that was a little Freudian slip there. Assessing the Obama administration's handling of this crisis. And I'm going to first stress what is on the positive side, and then I'm going to turn to the negative. On the positive side, and I think this is fairly interesting, President Obama today, he has been restrained, and he's received some criticism for that. But part of it, I think, is a good thing that he's been restrained, because he has not made this a personal issue for him. He has not made the revolution all about him or all about the U.S. He has been cautious. He has been careful. And I think that is probably the way to go in a general sense. And his handling of the crisis to date has reminded me a lot of George Bush Sr. and how George Bush handled the crises and the revolutions in Eastern Europe in 1989. If you recall, the Berlin Wall fell in November 1989, and at that time, President Bush was not very vocal in supporting the revolutions. I mean, he did. He talked about it. But the media criticized him for not being more up in front of the issue and showing U.S. leadership. In fact, his advisors said, President Bush, you've got to go to Berlin and show up and meet with what's going on, meet with the protesters and the new government. And President Bush said, no, I am not going to be seen dancing on the wall. Basically saying, I'm not going to put my credibility and U.S. prestige on the line. It's not my place. It's not our place. He chose the tactic of being a wise statesman, being restrained, thinking of a larger strategic interest. And that probably was a good thing. Right? He allowed the Soviets a little bit of dignity to withdraw the Red Army from Eastern Europe. So at the time, he was criticized, but in retrospect, it was very smart policy. Okay. Number two, President Obama has been very active behind the scenes, particularly behind the scenes diplomacy. Numerous reports, he's been on the telephone with President Mubarak, that various administration officials, economics, military officials, NSC, all sorts of individuals have been calling their counterparts in Egypt, trying to convince them to transition the regime to somehow bring an end to this crisis in a way that will, meet the aspirations of the Egyptian people, the people on the street. There are reports that Secretary of Defense Robert Gates was talking to his counterparts all last week, particularly on Thursday and Friday. Friday was, I think, the biggest protest to date. And his message was that the army has to protect the protesters, have to be restrained, but not only be restrained, but protect the people. And there were fears about on the largest demonstrations to date, would the army crack down? And they didn't. And some people have said, well, the U.S. has been very helpful in these backdoor channels in making sure that the Egyptian army acted responsibly. And I think that's good policy, right? That's what I hope the president is doing. And I hope he's doing a whole lot more than what I know and what the public knows, trying to pressure the regime to change. All right. That's the positive side. Let's look at the negative side. My assessment, the Obama administration was very slow in the uptake, a very slow initial reaction. And this really is not, everybody was, right? No one knew this was coming. And when a revolution sparks, there is a lot of uncertainty, as Ed was talking about. I mean, you cannot handle events. You're just trying to keep up. You're trying to, you're huffing and puffing. You're trying to keep up and running so fast. But the world's changing too fast for you to handle what's going on. That being said, they still made some initial gaffes. Okay. Vice President Biden, on January 27th, that's like day three of the protests, this is the Thursday before the first Big Friday protest. He had an interview with PBS on NewsHour, and he said Mubarak has been an ally of the United States. He's been helpful in a number of things. I would not refer to him, Mubarak, as a dictator. Okay. So 3 nights into the revolt, the democratic demonstrations, number two politician in the United States said Mubarak's our friend, and in fact, he's not even a dictator. This is bad public diplomacy. This is a mistake. Okay. Why is it a mistake? Because it puts us on the side of a dictator, coddling a dictator. And that's a problem we have. We don't want to be seen doing that. And our past statements from President Bush, President Obama, is that there needs to be change in the region. And when change happens, we back the horse that's there. That's problematic. And I know that's a gaffe. I know it was very early on, but that we should not have our leader saying something like that. Should be a little bit more restrained, I think. Now, since that time, over the weekend, and by February 1st, you have seen the Obama administration move in its policies. It's moved more towards the democratic protesters in the street to their, to their point of view. We've been more critical of Mubarak. We've asked for the regime to actually start transitioning. And in fact, it was February 1st that President Obama says there needs to be transition now. It needs to be orderly. And he didn't just say now. He says now meaning yesterday. And that's a fairly strong statement, right? And it shows the change from 5 days prior, or actually less than that, 3 days prior when Vice President Biden was saying he's a strong ally and he's our, you know, he's our friend and he's not even a dictator, to now there needs to be a transition that needs to happen immediately. There has been that movement. Other problems, again, it's mostly a problem of mixed signals. The Obama administration has more or less been sending out confusing signals that can be highly misinterpreted. And I think this stems from this dual desire for security and democratization at the same time. We want stability in the country to be, you know, somehow reimposed, but we also want democracy to flourish. And these two are in tension with each other right now. And we're trying to have our cake and eat it too. It's very hard to do. Let me give you an example. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was in Munich over the weekend at the Munich Security Conference, and she said, revolutions overthrow dictators in the name of democracy, only to see the process hijacked by new autocrats who use violence, deception, and rigged elections to stay in power. Basically saying, the United States is very, very wary of the revolutions, and we fear that these revolutions will be hijacked and some other autocrat or dictator will come into power. Right. You have the president saying there needs to be transition now. You have the Secretary of State 2 days ago, you know, 3 days ago, saying more or less, we're a little hesitant about what's happening. We're very fearful. The president's top envoy, his emissary to Egypt, Frank Wisner, at the same conference, he more or less said that President Mubarak must stay in office to steer these changes through. I therefore believe that President Mubarak's continued leadership is critical. Now, how do you square that with President Obama's saying there needs to be a transition right now? It needs to happen immediately. Yet we still need to keep the same dictator, President Mubarak, in office. I think it's these dueling interests coming into conflict. And this is not just a problem of President Obama. Let's go back to President Bush Sr. He did the same thing in Eastern Europe. If you fast forward to 1991, he visited Kiev, Ukraine, August of 1991. He gave his infamous Chicken Kiev speech. What am I talking about here? The Soviet Union was starting to break up. The Ukrainians were wanting an independence movement. The president shows up. And he says, this is what he says, quote, freedom is not the same thing as independence. Americans will not support those who seek independence in order to replace a far-off tyranny with a local despot. Yes, President Bush was very restrained in East Germany, but in Ukraine the situation was different. And he was trying to show restraint, and he actually was on the wrong side of history in that instance, because just a couple of weeks later there was a coup in the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union basically was dead just a couple of months later, and Ukraine did get their independence, but the U.S. was not a part of that process, or not as much as they should have been, because we were so cautious. Now, let's go to this final point that I was going to bring up, this tension between our security interests and our national values. I think, in my assessment, that in the Egyptian revolts and revolutions we're seeing today is that we should promote our national values over our strategic interests. I think we're not doing that enough. And I say that for a number of reasons. Number one, I think our policy to date has been restrained and cautious, but it's been based in fear. Fear of instability, fear of change, fear of the Muslim Brotherhood, fear of what's going to happen to Israel. It has not been hope and change. President Obama is an inspirational speaker. He ran on a platform of hope and change. And he has not been, to date has not sounded very hopeful. I went back and listened to a speech by Ronald Reagan when he talked about solidarity, and he supported the solidarity movement. And this was in December of 81. And that speech was incredibly inspirational, talking about American ideals, how the Polish people are being oppressed by the military dictators there, Jaruzelski. And it was very uplifting. I haven't heard an uplifting speech from President Obama to date. I know he can do it, but he hasn't done it yet. And I think it's because, again, we've we're operating from this negativism and not from optimism and hope. Second problem with not putting our values in front of our strategic interests. I think we don't have a stability problem in the Middle East. Right? That should sound really strange, right? Because the Middle East is highly unstable. Well, yes, it's highly unstable. And why is it unstable? Well, President Bush, President Obama, they both said it's unstable because there's a lack of freedom and democracy in the region. And we don't have a stability problem. We have a hypocrisy problem in our foreign policy. More or less, people on the street in Cairo do not believe the rhetoric of the United States that we stand for freedom, democracy, and yet we are able to deal with Mubarak and try to keep him in office or slowly nudge him out. We're not being supportive enough. And this is a problem specific to the Middle East, right? The people on the street believe this, and we are not able to address it. I think the time for addressing it has probably already passed, so the damage is done. But I had hoped that we would have been, again, more inspirational in this process. Third, we do have a Mubarak problem. President Mubarak is more or less damaged goods. Sure, he could hang on. He's going to try to hang on to power, as all good dictators or bad dictators try to do. The problem we have with him is that if we legitimize any process or any agreement where he remains in office till the September elections, I don't think the people on the street would accept that. They would blame the United States for coddling a dictator. I hope that in backroom channels that we are pressuring Mubarak to resign tomorrow or the next month as soon as possible. I know we cannot satisfy the protesters, all their demands, but ushering out Mubarak will actually signal that there's change. And if we can help that process, that to me is the smarter foreign policy. The reason I say that is because, fourth, if the democratic aspirations of the Egyptian people are not met, if they're stymied or frustrated, that to me is a greater danger. Because then they will give up hope, and they may, they could be passive and go back to being quiet. I think something's going to happen instead. They may turn to radicalism. And the longer this is drawn out, I think that danger increases exponentially. I think if we frustrate their aspirations, or we are seen as frustrating their aspirations, that's going to come back to bite us in the long term. And a radical regime in Egypt that comes into power in, say, 5 years or 5 months, in reaction to the events today, would be a horrible thing for the United States. I know some people in the media are saying, if we do allow democracy to flourish, this would happen. I actually think if we don't help democracy flourish, this will happen. And that, to me, is the greater strategic threat. And it was, in this sense, it's better to align our national values or align our strategic interests to reflect our national values. Long term, it's a very good strategy. But politicians hate instability. They hate uncertainty. They like to be in control of the situation. They're not in control. We need to have a little bit more faith and optimism. And that's my assessment of the situation. Thank you.
Well, lots of food for thought and discussion and questions. I want to just pose a question to the other three panelists to respond to Andy's last point, having to do with, I guess, a recommendation for U.S. foreign policy. Do you agree with that, or do you think it even matters? I mean, do you think that the U.S. is just whatever messages they send to Egypt? Egypt has its own dynamic, and the U.S. can be right or wrong for American political purposes, but it can't influence events in Egypt. So what do you make of that? Yeah, Andy?
I think sometimes when we talk about democracy, we have a tendency to pat ourselves on the back about what good supporters of democracy we are. And I think what you see a lot of times, and some of the potential for these problems keeps reasserting itself, is some of the things that my Middle Eastern friends have told me. And they said, you know, you talk a really good game about free elections and democracy, except when we elect somebody you don't like. Okay? And so there's really kind of only one kind of democracy you're going to be able to support if you're truly saying that that's a pillar of your foreign policy. And that's let the cards fall where they may democracy. It's not, you don't want to be in a situation where you demand free elections and beat up a country to have free elections, and then they have free elections, and you beat them up worse because you don't like who they've elected. And I think that's something we have to consider when we're asking ourselves about democracy promotion. Can we live with the Muslim Brotherhood as the most important player on the political scene in Egypt? And if we can't, if it's absolutely unacceptable for that to occur, then probably it's better to think about that before you advocate it than look like a complete hypocrite after this has occurred. If you look at the Pew polling in the Middle East about how many people in the Middle East believe we actually support real democracy, the numbers are astounding. You're going to get, you know, 10%, 12%. In Jordan, which I've had a chance to look at, it's a very small group. So I think that this added dimension has to be considered, and make real sure you can deliver on the promises before you make those promises. So.
Two things. I think one would be overstating it to say that the U.S. can't influence things. The U.S. can have an influence. It just can't control.
Right.
And that's a big difference. To the extent that the U.S. can influence things, then I'd actually endorse what Andy said. I think it's worth betting on the right side. For reasons that you've heard. There are other people in the region trying to hijack this thing. Our good friend, the president of Iran, has claimed that this is an uprising in support of Islamic revolution, and the Supreme Guide has said similar things. The Iranian opposition, quite rightly, has said, no, this is people power, this is about democracy, these are the values we espouse, the Iranian opposition. But who are people in Tahrir Square paying attention to among foreign leaders? Who are people in Tunisia paying attention to among foreign leaders? They're sort of waiting for Obama, but they're mostly written him off by this point. Mm-hmm. I tell you who they really like is Erdogan. They love the Prime Minister of Turkey. Why? Because the Prime Minister of Turkey went before his parliament and said, here's my message to President Mubarak. It's time to go. Your people have legitimate aspirations. Fulfill them. And here's a man who has credibility. I mean, he's certainly no angel, but he has credibility with the populations in the Middle East because he is a Muslim Democrat. Erdogan is... His stock is very, very high. If you want to invest in someone in the region at the moment, that's the one. Obama could be doing that kind of thing. Now, the bet may go badly, right? You may have a Tiananmen Square situation. You may back the Democrats, and then they will end up dead. That's a terrible outcome. But I think it's worth the risk, frankly.
It's a complex question that Andy has actually tried to deal with. And it's one actually, and all the War College students that are here, and God bless you, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, you deal with this one all the time. We were talking about it this past week in some classes. Where do you balance your national values, which are considered core national interest in the national security strategy, against, you know, those strategic interests that you were just talking about? When I look at the Middle East, and I don't have the benefit of David Cummins' historical perspective, but I try to be as
historical as I can be for a political scientist. I just see, you know, it's like Groundhog Day. You know, it's like the same thing happening over and over again. So I look at Egypt now from the U.S. foreign policy perspective, and I remember the fall of the Shah of Iran and the rise of the Islamic Revolution and the Veliaht Faqih there that came the end of the 1970s and the beginning of the 1980s. And by that I mean that not that the events are in any necessarily connected way, that they're the same events or similar, but they pose the same kind of quandary for U.S. foreign policy. Iran was our best friend in the region, except, you know, for Israel. And, you know, the centerpiece of the Baghdad Pact in the 1950s and 60s. And the Shah of Iran was, you know, our favorite dictator, our favorite autocrat. And Jimmy Carter tried to nudge him near the end. And then one day the people woke up and said, he must go. And we were caught trying to straddle the picket fence, which I'm told is a very uncomfortable position to be in. And that's sort of where we are today with Egypt. It's a good bit closer to Israel, obviously. It's a good bit more important, maybe, to the Israeli peace position in the region. But the same quandary is there for our political leadership. And so the one question that I've been really wondering about, and this is more of a political science-y question, but since we have Andy Terrell here, and he spoke of both Yemen and Jordan, I'd really like to throw this out there as a follow-on or as a sort of add-on to what you were asking. It seems to me that there have been sort of, with the exception of Veliaht Faqih and some other places, there have been sort of two basic kinds of regimes in the region these last 50 years or so. The hereditary, you know, monarchical types of governments, and then those governments that have some sort of presidential state, like we saw in Iraq, in Syria, in Egypt, in Tunisia. And so now we have the potential in both Jordan, where we have the Hashemite kingdom, and in Yemen, where we have another case of a president who wants to, or who wanted to turn it over to his son if he couldn't live forever and be president forever. And I wonder if the monarchical states, if you will, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Oman, the Emirates, Qatar, Bahrain, if they're going, and Morocco, if they're going to be more resistant to this kind of people power, or if they are, will it be because of the economic largesse that they generally have because of the oil wealth in most of those cases, and Yemen is going to be more resistant? I was just wondering about that, and it's sort of as a follow-on to what you were saying. So I'm throwing a question to Andy. Is that okay?
Sure. I don't want to deny the other Andy a chance to talk. Okay. Well, of course, when we're looking at the Arab world, there's a joke that we have two kinds of governments, monarchy and republican monarchy. If you look at Egypt, there was suggestions very strongly believed that Gamal Mubarak would be the next president if his father had anything to do. We've already seen Bashar in Syria take power after his father, Libya, Saif al-Islam, Gaddafi, so we're seeing a number of people who are saying, we got rid of monarchy, why do we still have hereditary rule? Now, if you're taking a look at the monarchies and saying, are they more stable than some of the others, I would think that actually they are showing more signs of stability, but there's kind of a wild card in there, Larry, because monarchies are rich in many cases. Okay, so when you can start writing checks to your population, that makes a really, really big difference as to the level of their discontent. Mm-hmm. I think when we're looking, and Jordan, of course, is an exception. Jordan is not a rich monarchy, but it's certainly got a better standard of living than someplace like Yemen. So I would suggest that maybe that's not the dominant variable, that difference between those two, and that it has a lot to do with the general overall socioeconomic condition of each country and the hopes that young people, when they're looking at the country and looking at these Byzantium mazes of corruption and wasta and everything else, that they say, can I actually get ahead in this system? And, you know, in places like Egypt, of course, you have people that have gone to law school and have gone to college. And we saw that young Tunisian man who burned himself to death was a college graduate. You know, people that should have a legitimate right to feel that they're at least have a right to a decent living, if not to some upward mobility, and yet it doesn't occur. And I think when this doesn't occur in any system, you're going to have a real destabilizing effect. The one so far maybe exception is Syria, where the level of oppression seems so high that people are very careful before they go out on the streets. And I was in Syria in November, and it's a whole different animal than a lot of places in the rest of the Middle East.
I'm going to do something against the tenor so far and hand this over to the audience and ask people in the audience to pose concise questions and the panelists to pose concise answers so that we can answer as many questions as possible in a short time.
There will be students going around with microphones, so we'd like to take the first couple questions from Dickinson students, if possible.
We'll try.
We've discussed tonight, you've talked a lot about these sort of the youth bulge in these nations, and we've seen how strong this sort of youth demonstration movement can be in places like Tunisia and Egypt. Do you think these youth movements can sort of cash these checks? Can they produce strong democratic leaders that can sort of take the reins of these revolutions and move these countries forward? Or will we just see another spate of dictators step in, sort of clean up the
role
and take over?
Well, I think that one's actually probably aimed at what I talked about, although I'm sure you want to hear from the others. I think that's the crux of the problem. At least in Egypt, I don't think they can. Now, some would say, you know, a lot of money has gone missing. There's a very sort of rigid socioeconomic class in Egypt, distinctions, and it may be that, you know, the old guard, now the old guard, they were once the new guard, gets thrown out and the young folk come in and they change things around. But the truth of the matter is, you still say, well, what are we going to build the Egyptian economy on? Suez Canal payments, worker remittances have largely dried up. Tourism is a big industry. There's some oil and gas. But I mean, for the most part, this is not a country that, you know, has a lot that you want to buy here in the United States, or that they can produce more cheaply than the Chinese or others. So it is going to be a problem for whoever, you know, whoever the next set of leaders are. Andy mentioned that, you know, there's concern about the Muslim Brotherhood coming in. I don't think they really will. But when I was asked this question the other day by, other folks in the government, I said, you know, I hope so, because let them have the first turn at bat, you know, because I think they're going to fail, whoever comes in. And then maybe technocrats that are more reasonable and forward-looking can have a turn. Maybe by then they can begin to find a way forward. And, you know, we're not going to talk about it because he said to be concise, but the complete failure of the Egyptian educational system over the last, you know, 30 years or so is a really interesting kind of side note to this, which we could talk about offline. I'm sorry, you probably want to get into this.
I would just answer, we don't know. We don't know if they're going to produce leadership and if they can. I think they have the ability. And if you look at history and different revolutions, leaders have come from really different places, and they don't ever always show themselves at the very beginning of a protest, but they kind of arise organically. And so we haven't seen the process in yet, and it's definitely possible you could have a somewhat smooth transition to a more open and representative form of government in Egypt. Also highly likely another dictator or authoritarian figure will come in.
Yeah, this is Egypt, which, you know, has had pharaohs for thousands of years. Yeah. And Hosni is another pharaoh, by the way, but that's a different story.
I think.
Sorry, can we take another question? I'm just going to do as much power as possible.
Sure, I don't think.
I'll be on.
Professor Wolf spoke a lot about balance between national interests and national security, or national interests, national values. And it seemed like most of you were in favor of choosing national values. But what about the real interests that we have in Israel? The Suez Canal, I didn't hear a lot about that. How would you handle those things, given that we really don't know who would fill the void, and it could be someone who could be anti-American? How would you address those issues?
I think that the Suez Canal is going to remain open to the extent possible if, by any government, because no government wants to give up one of its main sources of revenue. And so I think that that's going to occur. We might not get preferential treatment for U.S. military ships anymore, but I would suggest that that's going to occur. The Israeli thing is, of course, that's the million-dollar question. Would they actually continue to honor the March 1979 treaty if a new group came into power that included Muslim Brotherhood elements? And that's a very good question. But I do want to kind of point out, when we're looking at this issue, that Egypt is not Iran, in that Egypt, for all of the reasons Larry's talked about being very poor, it has a lot of interest, a lot of good reasons to stay closely involved with the West, to continue to have good economic relations with the West, to continue to have good aid relations with the West. It doesn't have oil to fall back on if it decides to have a xenophobic revolution or a revolution that renounces some of the systemic aspects of the region, including the 1979 treaty. So I would hope, at least, that unless we get a group of absolute ideologues, that people stop and think that their political actions could have economic implications that the country's not going to be able to cope with very well, and therefore They need to be wary about that. And I would also add that I think a lot of Egyptians, and Larry's the expert, not me, on Egypt, know this, especially in the Egyptian middle class. The Egyptian merchants and such like that are aware of the fact that it's probably not in their best interest to undermine the economic relations with the West. And just one other thing is, if you've ever been to Egypt, one of the most aggravating things that you can deal with is the people that are constantly trying to sell you things and constantly trying to be your tour guide. It just gets so old so fast. But it does underscore the fact that one of their major sources of income is tourism. And if you're seen as a bunch of wild-eyed radicals trying to redefine the world, that doesn't help tourism either. So I don't want to project too much optimism into the situation, but I will say there's a lot of things that have to be done if anybody's going to do anything approaching a serious cost-benefit analysis. Larry, if you want to tell me I'm wrong, I'm straying into your territory.
No, it's headstrong.
I'm not going to tell you you're wrong. I think two points on this. First, I don't think we should be too fixated on the Muslim Brotherhood. The whole political spectrum in Egypt don't love the treaty with Israel. You know, the left don't love it. The liberals don't love it. Nobody loves it, and nobody in the regime particularly loves it. But it is in Egypt's strategic interest. And any government of Egypt, barring complete wacko ideologues, which doesn't seem like a likely outcome, is going to recognize that. And so, yes, we can't be absolutely sure about this, but Egypt's strategic interests are relatively permanent. And they include things like being able to feed people. And I think that's the best guarantee, not which dictator is friendly or not in the palace. It's any government running Egypt has far better things to worry about than whether it's going to be a good idea to have a war with Israel. They have no interest, unless we get the bizarre outcome. But it's so different from Iran that I think that's a minimal chance.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know you want another question, but I'm just going to say very quickly, I think it's about finding a way to mesh national values with national interests or our conception of our strategic interests so that they work together rather than pull apart. And that's hard to do in a situation like this because, you know, it wasn't that we one day woke up and said, we'd love to have a good dictator in Cairo. How about this guy Mubarak? And, you know, he got there because Anwar Sadat was assassinated. Why was he assassinated? Well, because they don't like the treaty with Israel. In fact, in Egypt, it's known as the cold peace, or as I used to call it, the frozen peace, because no one likes it, no one wants it, except that no one wants to have another war with Israel either, except for crazy people. And it's not, as you just heard, really in their strategic interest. So I do think there's a clear melding of our interest and their interest. The difficulty is, as you heard in the analysis that Andy offered, is, you know, how does the American government sort of nudge Mubarak off the stage while at the same time not nudging him off the stage in such an overt way? So that we're not on the wrong side of history, but at the same time we're not sort of, you know, encouraging all the people all over the region to rise up against, you know, all of their leaders, and I think that's, you know, you can give him whatever grade you want, but I think the kind of the uncertainty and the tension in what we're doing, at least what we see in public, is a reflection of the difficulty in trying to do both of those things at the same time.
I'll take another question, please.
What do you think is a stronger motivation for the protests? The desire for improvement in their material welfare or the desire for a democratic government?
One strong desire is to stop being tortured by the secret police. I think more than an abstract idea of democracy or representative government or any of those things, which are important, and if you see a lot of the vox pops that the media are doing from the streets of Cairo, you'll find people from all walks of life saying very articulately, we need constitutional reform. We need guarantees of freedoms of this, that, and the other thing. That's important. But mostly they just want to stop being tortured. I think that is a huge driver of this. The Facebook page, as I mentioned, that helped kick this off, was a tribute to someone who was murdered by the police, which is far too routine in countries like Egypt. And I think that has been, you know, the socioeconomic stuff matters hugely, but I think that really, the what you see in the people the talking now from Meydan Tahrir, Liberation Square, is I feel free, right? And part of that feeling free is nobody's torturing me right now. Nobody's about to disappear me. And I think that is a huge part of this.
Yeah, I would just agree and yet also disagree in a way. I think that's what the people think they want, and they do want that. They want the political freedom. I know my students at AUC, when I taught there, you know, they used to protest, although always in very confined space. You could protest within the campus. You go off the campus, and then the police thugs are going to beat the crap out of you. And given that a lot of those guys in the police were lower class, poor kids from the, you know, the country, and these are upper class kids at the university, they were kind of, it was kind of a fun to do, you know. I was always like, good, do your protest, just do it around the library, don't go off into the streets. I mean, I think a lot of people, though, who didn't protest before, people in what we might call the lower middle class who are now in this, are thinking in terms of freedom, political freedom. But I think what I was arguing in my remarks is that I think at the end of the day, they're going to get political freedom, or they're going to get political change anyway, and they're going to find that the socioeconomic conditions are just as problematic as they were before, maybe not entirely in exactly the same way. And so this could be, you know, a long-run series with lots of branches and sequels and you know, spin-off shows that we get out of it.
We have time for one last question.
Why don't we
The Egyptian military wields a lot of power in the country, or so it seems. How much of that power do you think they'd be willing to give up to move toward constitutional democracy? And what would their role be in a new Egyptian government?
You know, it's interesting. The Minister of Defense, I think, has now been in power in that job, Field Marshal Tantawi, since early in Bill Clinton's term, first term of office. I'd have to go back and check. He's been in there forever. He's like the only general with his own walker, you know. I mean, I'm exaggerating. But
he's not the only one.
That's right. That's right. We have some guys. No, I'm just kidding. You know, he's been in there a long time, and it's sort of symbolic of the reality. I remember a decade ago when Hosni Mubarak was first suggesting, you know, Gamal would be a good president, you know, his one of his two sons. And the Egyptian generals got together and said, he is not from the military. That's what I was trying to say, that this is the third generation of leaders that have come from the military, but we're a long way from the revolution. This is an old regime. These are old generals. And the soldiers are just of the people. They're you guys in the audience who had to go do your national service, and someone said, okay, go to Dickinson and shoot those kids. You're going to do that? I don't know. For some 80-year-old guy who you've never seen before and you're pretty sure is corrupt? I don't know. I think the army is at a kind of a crossroads here. And what we don't know, but I was asking a friend today who's one of the leaders of this movement, is what the majors, the captains, the colonels, the very people who did the Free Officers Revolt in the early 50s, what they're going to do. But what he was telling me from his friends who are in those ranks is, no way would they turn their guns on the people or play that role. So I think the problem for the Egyptian regime is that the army has become over time sort of a public works program in a country that has this big socioeconomic problem that I mentioned. I mean, when has Egypt fought a war? The last one they fought, the October War of 1973, they still commemorate as the war they won against Israel. It's in the museum. You can see it when you're off, as you come in from the airport. And I always would explain very gently that, no, actually, Israel won that war. You know, you scored the first goal. They scored all the other goals afterwards. And the actual final score was a lot to one. But there was a political victory out of that, you know, for the Egyptians that set up the Camp David process, perhaps you could say. And so I think the military is going to have a different role. They're going to have to be able to transition. And frankly, I think we're going to see different younger leadership come up, and we'll see Al-Tantawi and the others go. That didn't quite answer your question, but I wanted a piece of it.
Two brief points. One, I think what you've just heard suggests that the top brass in the military don't want to test the willingness of the rank and file or even junior officers to fire on unarmed civilians. So they're going to try to avoid that confrontation if they can. So today, for example, there's so many people in Tahrir that the numbers were big enough that they actually went and occupied the street in front of the Meclis Ashab, the People's Assembly, or the Shura, one of them,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they went to the upper house.
Okay, and so they're now, you know, the sit-in is sort of spread, and now they're camping out, sleeping out in that street. There were soldiers in front of there, and then I saw a report that the soldiers had left, right? They protected the space, but eventually they left when there were too many people and it might have come to a confrontation. And I think the army is probably going to keep doing that. They don't want to end up with Tiananmen. There are exceptions to this. The Presidential Guard,
right.
If the protesters go after Mubarak, if they go to the palace, they will die in large numbers. The Presidential Guard will have no difficulty at all shooting them down because they've been trained by the American Secret Service and the British SAS, and they know how to kill people.
And they're trained to do it, and they will do it. So those guys, that's a different thing. But the mainstream of the military is this. The other point is that the military is not just guys trained to fight wars. The Egyptian military is, it's like Eisenhower's worst nightmare of the military-industrial complex. They own real estate. They own industries. They are a huge economic force in the country. They're into everything. And disentangling that is not something that's going to happen overnight. And for there, I think you need to look at the process in Turkey, which, if you go back to the 50s or 60s in Turkey, the army was similarly into a lot of industries and has gradually withdrawn from many of them, although not all of them. That's a decades process. So how that gets negotiated, I think, is unclear. But we have to be clear what we're talking about when talking about the military. We're not just talking about guys with guns and tanks. We're talking about a vast business enterprise and the retirement villages for major generals and all this stuff. It's a vast part of the economy and society, and it's not what we ordinarily think of as the military.
And I would just say that I think the army, the Egyptian army, are the kingmakers right now. I mean, they really are holding the keys to the process. And if it's going to turn towards repression, it's really their responsibility. If they will decide to do that. And if they decide to let a civilian administration come about and kind of garner a democratic revolution that comes into power, and that they accept that civilian administration from elected officials, it's going to be up to them. And if they don't want that, I think we're stuck, or something else will happen. I don't know what they're going to do. I have no idea what the Egyptian army would do, but they're the key institution. I think when Mubarak fired his council, or half his council, I think 50% of the council is made up of former generals and military. I mean, they basically are running the government right now. And it's going to be hard to convince them to give up power in a sort of gradual way. They're going to have to do that if we want to see a sort of democratic flourishing. Or they may wake up and say, well, you don't really want that. Let's crack down. And then if they crack down, it's game over. I mean, it's a...
Yeah, can I just add one more thing that's a little off the topic of directly linearly answering the question, but at least it's one of the interesting things that strikes me about the future role of the Egyptian military is that this is a military which has an intelligence branch that very carefully screens its up-and-coming officers to make sure that they're not too committed to Islamism and that they don't have very close connections to any subversive groups or especially the Muslim Brotherhood. So it's going to be interesting to see that a military force that's as powerful politically as the Egyptian military, how it reacts if we do find ourselves with having an Islamist-leaning government. It might have a lot of problems with that. And then we are going to have to decide how we feel about that and what we think would be the best outcome if the tensions do break out between those two centers of power.
If I can just add one very quick last word. The word I heard today from protesters was that they're looking to put together a technocratic caretaker government that Mubarak would continue to sit above temporarily. And I would agree with this Andy and that one too. You said I was supposed to disagree a lot. In fact, the military would sort of have to sign off on that. But if you've noticed, Tantawi has been down in the streets. I don't know if any of you watched this. He's been down with the soldiers. I mean, he probably hasn't met a soldier in like a decade. I think what I've been hearing and what I've been seeing also on television suggests to me that there is a real sense, as I said earlier in my remarks, that the big stick is not available. That at the end of the day, they can't do Tiananmen Square. I hope they would never. But, you know, they can't go in and say, okay, we're going to crack down on this. That moment, if it was there, is gone. And so I think that's why you're seeing lots of little sticks. You know, we'll arrest this guy and beat him up and release him, and then we'll
promise constitutional changes, and then we'll do this, and then we'll do it back and forth to try to keep things unsettled.
On behalf of our forum, I'd like to thank our moderator and panelists for a very insightful remarks.
David,
this concludes our event.
You did a great job.
Well, thank you for inviting us over here.
Yeah,
I'm glad to be sitting in your panel with you. It was great.
Well.